So we're in the middle of the story of Yosef and Potiphar's wife, and Chazal tell us, technically, chronologically, the story we just learned about Yehuda and Tamar, and the story of Yosef and Potiphar's wife, didn't happen the way it's written. They didn't happen adjacent to one another. But the Torah juxtaposes them to show us many, many correlations between the story, the two stories, and to tell us that just as Tamar intended for the sake of heaven, because she saw the Mashiach has to come from here and she wants a part of it, so too Potiphar's wife intended for the sake of heaven. That's what we said earlier. Ultimately we see from these two stories come the two Mashiach. And it's interesting, this is part of a concept we didn't get to develop here, that Yehuda comes from Leah, whose strength is to be proactive in her prayer and in her actions. And Yosef comes from Rachel, whose strength comes from withholding, from standing back, from self-control. And Yosef's whole strength in this story is that he pulled back, right? Yehuda, it's that he stood up and said, I'm wrong. I made a mistake. The strength of David is in his capacity to get back up again. Yosef is when he can hold back. Yeah, so back to our parasha. So Yosef sees the vision of his father, and Yosef refuses. And even though he and she, according to one opinion in the Gemara, they both had the same intent when he came home that day, he stood up to the test. So we see that sometimes even great people need external help to stand up to a test. It's normal. You can't say, I'll always be able to do it alone. No. Sometimes you need someone's help. It could be your spouse, it could be your Rebbe, it could be your parent. But sometimes you need that extra help to do what's right. Yeah?
Does that mean that you use the word test several times? You're saying that God tests people?
Yeah, for sure.
It doesn't say that God does not cause man sin, neither does he tempt any man.
No.
It doesn't.
Show me, where's that verse?
What does it say?
I can't place it. I don't know, it just popped right out as soon as you said it. It just came to mind.
Matthew something? Or
Matthew. No, it wasn't Matthew. How do you know about that?
I'm trying to think which verse you're translating.
Matthew didn't have any philosophical thoughts.
The verse says, "Mipi elyon lo tetzei ha'ra'ot v'atov." There's a verse in Eicha that says God doesn't make good or bad. Is that what you're referring to?
Oh no, it's in Job. It's in Job.
What's
would God, you? It's not, God is not the one who lays a stumbling block. I think is before a man, neither does he touch.
Just a second, I'll check for the word stumbling block in Job, but I don't think there's such a verse.
Did you read Hebrew on the website?
What? No. I wouldn't use it.
Why not?
Because their philosophy is not Jewish.
Which?
I know what it is, but I spoke to them. Okay, stumbling block I don't see.
It may be an English translation word.
Anyone have internet here? You want to check?
How about you old English? Oh. Tempteth. Are there any hints in
where do
this version that you have? Like, this is all the old English?
I have it in Hebrew. I don't have it in English.
So, maybe tempt. Because the tempting isn't done very much.
But if you'd quoted to me from Job, that there are parts of Job which are like Ecclesiastes, which are arguments which are not accepted. Meaning, I'm just saying, that wouldn't necessarily mean it's an accepted philosophy, but I'd have to see the verse you're talking about.
No,
I'm saying just as in Ecclesiastes, there's a to and fro, until ultimately certain opinions are rejected and others accepted. So the same is true with Job. So it could be you're quoting me a verse in Job, I don't remember.
Well, it's like he's talking with the three men that come to mourn with him. And they begin telling him that maybe it's something you did, and God doesn't do things for that reason.
It's Matt, yeah.
And then he it goes on and he says, believe me, I've done nothing wrong. And then he starts telling how he wishes he'd been much better, he'd never been born. But then he says something that later on, I know that the three men are considered to be very wrong, they're rebuked by God at the end of the story, but Job, at one point, he was rebuked by God also, because he had said something, indicating that God was maybe, because he said, why is the Almighty baiting me? It's like he wants me to die. And,
right.
And then he says, and then one of the men said, how dare you say such a thing against God? He doesn't bless anyone. He doesn't cause any man to attempt at anyone. I think that's what happened, if I'm not mistaken.
So that could be. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Could be.
It's a long, long dialogue.
That's the whole book, right? But that I don't remember.
I don't know. It just came up. But the whole idea of God tempting people too. It's like on a basic level, I don't see how it would. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me, the idea of God tempting someone. Isn't there enough temptation without God, Himself coming down and setting things up?
Ah, that's your point. Okay, so fine. So let's say it not that way. Fine. I didn't realize that was your point. So I didn't mean to say God specifically says Joe Schmo should have temptation today. Bam, let him have temptation. No. When I said God tempting, I didn't mean in that direct a fashion. Okay.
The test, you said, was the word. It was like a test specifically designed for this person. So I thought this might be... I'm the one who used the word tempt. I was thinking of the word. But
again, I'll agree with you that life in and of itself is enough of a test. There are levels of... there are levels and situations, and I am choosing the course of least resistance in my argument with you. I can definitely accept that a person will say there's the course of nature, and nature in and of itself provides the tests.
But you can't say that everything's the test, because then there's no room to say that anything else is a test. Everything will be tested.
Different scenarios are different tests. I do think that under a different circumstance, if I didn't have to argue it philosophically, I would say something else. But from a philosophical level, you can definitely say what you're saying, and that's within a concept of a Jewish approach to what's going on here. So I'd rather say that than argue the other points with you. You understand what I'm saying? I'm saying, technically, I do think God tests a person. Technically, I do think that a person specifically has temptation that's set up for him and tested for him. But I don't think you have to accept that or say that way within Jewish thought. So I'd rather go the path of least resistance and just not say that. Say, okay, fine. So say this way. I'm just discerning between what I really think and what I'm willing to argue about. Meaning I... Okay. Back to our parsha. So, Yosef is wearing a rope. And he's trying to pull away. And she grabs the rope. Now, in those days, if you think about it, I don't know if you guys ever saw these pictures... think of a long rope, and they're not wearing anything underneath. All the way through the Second Temple, they weren't wearing anything underneath. It was a rabbinic institution in the beginning of the Second Temple that women should wear underwear. It used to be that they didn't wear anything underneath. They just wore a long rope. So Yosef is wearing this long rope, and she grabs it, and he tries to pull back, and she's pulling forward. and he slips out of the robe. He sees he's not going to get out, and he slips out of the robe and runs outside, and he's wearing nothing underneath. So he's standing out in the courtyard naked. What's she to do? She waits until everyone comes home and says, "Oh, didn't you all hear me yelling? I was yelling at the top of my lungs that that Hebrew slave the master brought here to fool around with me. He came to lay with me, and I yelled, and then he ran out. And he ran out in such a panic, I was left here with his garment." She leaves the garment there, and she waits till that night. They're lying in bed, and as they're doing intimate things, she starts saying, "You know, someone else tried doing all this earlier today." And she's purposely trying to get him all riled up. And she literally points to the actions he's doing in bed and says, "He was doing the exact same thing exactly where you are. When I yelled, he was stuck. His garment was still here." And she shows him he has the garment. So one of the Midrashim say that there was a child in the room. A child who had never spoken before. And the child started speaking and saying, "That's not true. You're telling a lie. You started up with him. He ran away from you." So now they're all embarrassed. They wait a second, what's going on? So they convene a court. And the Egyptian priests say, "Well, according to your version of the story, lady, he was trying to approach you. And according to his version of the story, he was trying to run away. So let's look at the robe." So they take the robe and they examine the robe. And they find that the back of the robe is frayed. So that's a clear indication that he was pulling his neck back and she was pulling forward. And so the back where his neck was being pressuring against the robe is frayed in a way that looks like he was really, she's pulling vehemently towards her and he's pulling vehemently away from her. And so the Egyptian priests tell Potiphar, "We're very sorry to tell you, but her story doesn't add up and his does." Case dismissed. They leave the room. Potiphar's stuck. Now he knows his wife is a liar. And she's the one that's been running after Yosef. So what's he supposed to do? He can't leave Yosef home. What? Okay, he's a eunuch. He's not, you gotta wonder what kind of marriage he had altogether. So what's he supposed to do? He likes Yosef. He sees that his success has come through Yosef. So he doesn't want to lose Yosef. He needs Yosef. He's his top accountant. He's got his whole business being run by Yosef. So he puts Yosef in the VIP ward of the prison. So Yosef is sitting with all the top politicians and all the top people, and he's starting to hear as he's serving them what's going on behind the scenes throughout Pharaoh's palace. And he's getting an inside view from all these people who have, you know, they each have their issue with someone. Someone put them there. And he's starting to learn politics. So he's in prison. He's in prison for a long time. I don't remember. The Medrash gives a number. It's somewhere around a decade. I don't remember. I don't remember if it was 7 years or 12 years. He's in prison a long time.
But how did he end up in prison if he was found not guilty?
Well, when his master is the chief executioner of Pharaoh, so he could put him wherever he wants.
Right. I guess that actually answered my question. I was surprised that they would find him not guilty in the first place since he was a Jewish slave.
So the commentaries say that that's why at the end of the book of Bereishis, we find that Yosef makes all kinds of institutions to benefit the Egyptian priests. He frees them from taxes, and his institutions are really a way of repaying them for their being honest when they were judging him back when he was a slave.
So pretty much Yosef was the first Hebrew slave.
I guess, yeah. First ever Hebrew, yeah, I guess, right?
So but does that hold any weight when it comes to Maaseh Avot, Siman Levanim?
Yes. Yes, the Medrash says, follow Yosef. Wherever he goes, they put him down. Wherever they put him down, he floats up like oil. That's the history of the Jewish people. Wherever we go, we're put down. They make a million laws to make it impossible for us to succeed. They boycott us. They do everything against us. And wherever we go, we keep floating to the top. And that's been our history. The Medrash says Long before there were Nobel Prizes. Long before there were statistics that could measure this. The Midrash says that's the history of the Jewish people, just like Yosef. And if you look at Yosef closely, you'll see he's always second in command, always very faithful, always the brains behind the business, and always bites the bullet even though he's done everything right. He's in the right, and yet he bites the bullet. What?
Tzadik.
He is, yeah. Yeah. What's he going to do? So, we learn another concept from Yosef. The verse says, and this is a recurring theme in the Torah, V'chol ashehu oseh, Hashem matzliach biyado. Whatever he did, God granted him success with. And the Medrash learns that this is a formula in life. You have to do, and then you can find God's success. You're not going to find God's success if you don't take that step out. And there are many jokes, you guys probably know about this, with the guy sinking at sea, and the guy with the lottery ticket. Yeah, there are many famous jokes about that. So the concept is real, and even the Magen Miduvna we've been learning is in agreement with the concept. He's not saying, don't do your end of the deal. There's a balance. You got to do yours, and there's a hand that runs the show behind the show. So Yosef finds favor in the eyes of the master. And again, he's exceptionally successful. And he's put in charge of the jail. And the head of the jail goes on vacation and he leaves Yosef in charge. He doesn't even look over his shoulder. So everyone's talking about Yosef. And Hashem has it that the two servants of Pharaoh mess up. There's something new for people to talk about. The guy who carries the wine, he brings Pharaoh a cup of wine with a fly in it. So he's thrown into this VIP prison. And the guy, the baker, the guy who's in charge of all the good food that Pharaoh eats, one of the pieces of bread Pharaoh ate had a rock in it. And so he's thrown into prison. So Yosef is nice to them. And here we see another concept. The way Yosef treats a person, and it has nothing to do whether he's Jew or non-Jew, Yosef treats them nicely. And when he sees them upset, he asks them what's wrong. So they each had a dream. Our parsha began with dreams and it ends with dreams. And Yosef sees them all upset in the morning. And our tradition is that each one had two dreams, not one dream. Each one had a dream, and then each one dreamt the interpretation of the other one's dream. So they're both sitting there, and each one knows the answer to the other one's dream.
Why did they just tell each other?
Because they were meanies. Oh. So each one's sitting there, and each one tells the other one what he dreamt, and the guy hears his dream and says, "Bummer, what a dream. I wonder what it means." And he doesn't tell him that he dreamt the answer. And then he says, "But you know, I had a terrible dream. Let me tell you my dream." And he tells him the dream, and the first guy hears it and says, "Bummer, what a dream." And neither one is going to reveal to the other one, "Hey, you know, I dreamt the interpretation for your dream." So they're sitting there, and Yosef walks in and sees them upset. And he says, "Why are you guys upset today?" And they say, "We dreamt a dream, and we don't have anyone here who could figure out the meaning." So we already said that our tradition is that the meaning of the dream goes by the interpretation. But no one's interpreting the dream. So Yosef says, "Well, God's in charge of interpreting dreams. Tell me, please, your dreams." So who volunteers first? The guy who carried the wine. So he, the butler, he tells his dream. And he tells his dream about the grapevine with three branches that's all ripe, and he carries Pharaoh's cup on his hand. And from here comes the Kabbalistic concept you've probably seen people do, that when they make Kiddush, they carry the cup on their hand, they place the cup on the palm of their hand. This is a Kabbalistic concept. Technically, you don't have to do it. I mean, we don't usually carry a cup like that. So Pharaoh had it, you know, and their cups probably had a flat bottom. We have those cups with a stem. Go try carrying it on that. You know, okay, well, you could. Kabbalistically, maybe you should. So Pharaoh gets the cup from him. So Yosef tells him the interpretation is in 3 days, Pharaoh will reseat you on your position and you will again give him to drink. So Yosef then asks him for a favor. "Remember me. Please mention me to Pharaoh. Get me out of this house. I was stolen from the Hebrews. I didn't do anything wrong that I was put here." So the baker sees that Yosef gave a good interpretation. What does that mean? So one interpretation among our sages is the baker knew Yosef got it right because he dreamt that very interpretation. So that's what it says. He gave a good interpretation because he knew that interpretation's right. The other interpretation we have of what this means is that he saw that Yosef's interpreting the dreams for good. He's giving a good interpretation to the dreams. There's a happy ending. So he figures, let me share my dream with him. But he's not going to have any such luck. So the commentaries here discuss why was the baker so much worse. So the simple understanding is that Pharaoh said, you know, a fly could have flown in as you were bringing me the wine. That's not necessarily your fault. You deserve another chance. But a stone, that's gross negligence. That means you didn't sift the flour well. But the commentaries do go into why the baker was more sinful than the wine bearer and why he deserved a mean interpretation to his dream. According to that tradition, then Yosef really gave it into him. Yosef gave him an interpretation that was really hurtful to him, killed him. So that's discussed over here, that the baker... Okay, I don't want to go into it. Why? Because I'm not sure I'm remembering it accurately, so I don't want to say it. I'm not sure if what I'm remembering is exactly what it says in the Medrash. I want to look it up before I say it.
Everyone knows if you work in a kitchen what the baker does.
I'm not sure I'm going to find it so fast. So let's finish the parsha, and then if we have a chance, I'll look it up. I'll look for it. So there's a famous mashal, there's a famous interpretation over here from the Magen Midovna. The Magen Midovna, you guys know the mashal of the Magen Midovna here? You'll hear it once, you'll remember it like I remember it. When I was a child, they told me this, that there was once a contest the king made to see which painter could draw the nicest painting. So one painter draws, another painter draws, and everyone's drawing their paintings. And finally, the king comes and looks at all the paintings, and he brings his board of advisors, and they're looking, and they're grading, this painting is this, and that painting is that. And finally, they hit a certain painting where a person is carrying some fruits on his head, and a bird that's flying overhead comes down and tries to eat from those fruits. So the painter says, "You see how good my painting is? Even the birds thought it's real." So another painter standing there, and he's worked really hard. He wants to win, so he says, "Well, that's true. Your fruits are very nice. But you didn't draw the person well, because if they really thought that was a person in your painting, they wouldn't have approached the fruits." So what's the idea here? That Yosef sees that the baker has bread on his head, and the birds aren't scared of coming and pecking at the bread on his head while he's carrying it. So Yosef says, that's an indication you're not alive in the dream. Those three loaves of bread are 3 days, but if the birds aren't scared of eating it off of your head, then there's something wrong. They should have been scared of you. So that's what Yosef tells him. In 3 days, your head will be lifted from upon you. You're going to be hung. And that's what happens. Now, Chazal tell us that when Yosef asked a favor of the wine bearer, he made a mistake. So that's a big question. What mistake did he do? We just said, you got to do your ishtadlus. So why did he make a mistake? So there are multiple interpretations here. One interpretation is that on his level, every person based on their level has an amount of ishtadlut they should do. And this was beyond his ishtadlut. Another interpretation is in the way he asked it, he was putting his faith in the wine bearer. We said you can do ishtadlut. The question is how do you approach it? If you say, I'm going to do this, so for sure it's going to work. I'm going to eat fat-free foods, and I'm going to do everything healthy, so I'm for sure going to live to 120. So that's not an approach God likes. God says, do yours, but don't assume it's going to work. God doesn't even like it in spiritual things. It says if you pray, and you say, I was so focused in my prayer, for sure God's going to answer my prayer. So that's a segula, that's an amulet, that your prayer will not come true. Talmud says, if you pray, and you're confident it's going to happen because you prayed so well, you could be confident it's not going to happen. That's what the Gemara says. So the other interpretation says that Yosef put in too much faith. And he says, you know, I did him so much good. I did him such a favor. For sure, this is what's going to get me out of here. And his approach was with too much confidence in the Sar HaMashkim. So, okay, those are two, there are more. But this is a difficult question where our sages say that he was a wicked person. Because here he could have done Yosef a favor and he didn't. And even when he will ultimately mention Yosef, he's going to say a lot of bad about him, as we'll see next week. But there was an aspect where Yosef deserved it, and that we'll explore B'zachim. Maybe we'll explore a little bit better next week.